Did you guys like the reunion? Did you guys miss me?
A little bit.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week, and I'm very happy about this. We do not have a round table, but it is definitely the baseball writers of the round table by my beat colleagues at the Post-Dispatch. Lynn Worthy and Daniel Guerrero are here at the Treehouse Studios, and we're going to start right off with a rule explanation. How exciting is that? All right, Daniel, how did Victor Scott II end up with 94 stolen bases and not 95 stolen bases this minor league season?
Yeah, well, I mean, Victor Scott really rose up the prospect ranks this year with a huge season, offensively at the plate and on the base paths, and defensively as well. Originally finished the year with 95 stolen bases, had a one bag lead over Rays prospect Chandler Simpson, who's also a friend of Victor Scott's, for the MILB lead. Turns out, though, a couple weeks after Springfield season ended, there was a stat correction to a game right around the first or second week of September, where situation plays out. Victor Scott's on second, Noah Medlinger, infield kind of utility prospects on first base. Call for a double steal, and Victor, as he explained, didn't get the jump he wanted to and took kind of like two hard steps towards third base. Turns out that Medlinger just kind of kept going, and the throw, for whatever reason, went to first and then went to second and sailed into the outfield. Victor Scott ended up getting to third and then ended up scoring on the play. Turns out, though, that the play originally ruled a double steal was corrected after the fact to a throwing error, and Victor Scott advanced on the throw, wiped away his stolen base and his lead. So now he finishes 2023 as the co-leader in stolen bases, which is kind of an interesting thing, just because obviously it's no longer, you know, kind of the sole possession of first place, but also puts him in a tie with Simpson, they had kind of like a personal competition between each other. I mean, it kind of goes back to 2021 when they played summer ball together in the Northwoods League, and now, you know, that's up for debate of whose stolen base accomplishments were more impressive. Victor Scott's 94 between high A and double A, and Chandler Simpson's between low A and high A in the Rays system. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing to learn a couple weeks after the season ends, right? To think you have the stolen base crown and have that kind of stolen from you, in a sense.
He's still going, though. He's out in the Arizona Fall League, and by the best I can do, he stole one more base in the playoffs, already has six in the Arizona Fall League. So that gives him 101 for the calendar year, not including spring training. So in competitive games, non-exhibition games, he has a 101 stolen bases, which was his goal. He wanted to get to 100, so that counts, right? 101 and counting?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because when I asked him about that, about 100 being the main goal, he said it was, once he got closer, he thought like it was possible. His main goal was beating Chandler Simpson. Funny enough, I mean, the way he explained it, they're competitive off the field when they work out, when they bowl, when they would play ping pong together in summer ball. But I mean, 101 stolen bases. You still have a month left of the fall league left, and he's not slowing down from what it looks like.
Well, that gets the podcast off and running. Ba-doom-tsh, punning. Wow. Pun intended, yeah. Was that good?
That was okay.
All right.
That was good.
All right, thanks. I want to go now to Lynn. Lynn, was your first year in St. Louis covering baseball everything you hoped and dreamed it would be, with a 91 loss season and some time off to talk with me in mid-October?
I don't think I quite had hopes or dreams for the season. If I did, I would hope that they would be a little bit better than where this season ended up as far as the Cardinals. But, we got one season in the books.
We had good stories to tell, right? I mean, it was different covering a losing Well, you helped me through this.
Yeah, it was not as different as I probably anticipated it being coming over from Kansas City. Though, as I pointed out to a lot of people, because it was a running joke that my first year here, the Cardinals did as bad as they'd done in a long time, 30 plus years. I made sure to remind people that I think the Royals ended up with like 106 losses, where last year it was 97 losses. So I must have been worth at least a few reporter wins above replacement.
Yeah, though. Yeah, you're 6 reporter wins above replacement. I like that. Writer above replacement. That's what I like. What stood out to you? I mean, you were there every step of the way from spring training all the way through. What stood out to you about this season? And what did you feel was sort of the key to unplugging the Cardinals as a contender?
The pitching. I mean, the fact that they just didn't have consistent pitching from the start. And I think that first month of the season, they got off to such a slow start that even when they had a decent May where they were above 500, they really didn't gain that much ground. And then the pitching still just wasn't consistent as you went through June and, you know, into July. And it was, what, a couple weeks into July, I think, or was it maybe a week into July when John Mozeliak had the press conference and basically said, you know, they were going to look to, I mean, I don't know if he left the door open, but more or less said that they're probably going to be looking to sell at the trade deadline. I mean, he left the door open that they maybe, if they went on some ridiculous run, they might, you know, reverse course. But more or less at that point, he was already signaling that they're going to be looking to sell at the trade deadline. And I think that was mostly, in my mind, at least, pitching. Because at the time they made the trades, I remember looking it up at one point, at the time they made those trades in early August, the pitching rankings were way down. I mean, end of the season gets a little skewed because they started, you know, evaluating, bringing guys up, giving guys opportunity, however you want to say it. They're putting out a lot of guys they're just sort of getting looks at down the stretch. But even before they did that, like at that, you look at like August 1st, August 2nd, where they were with pitching, just wasn't good enough for them to be in contention.
Part of that was the minor league system not providing what they needed pitching-wise. Daniel, what do you make of how the depth chart began the season when you think about the top prospects and some of the young pitchers where like Zach Thompson, Matthew Liberatore, you know, some of the guys who hadn't yet got their foothold in the majors, but also then the McGreevies and Graceffos and Hences. What do you make of what the season did to the depth chart? And do you think it changed that much, or is it that much clearer who's on the horizon?
I think for certain prospects, yes. I mean, I think there are some of those kind of top, kind of higher ceiling prospects that you can still look at, right? Like Tim Kent's, his season was limited a little bit by injury. He obviously came back after missing a month. Got to Double-A, struggled in August, and finished the season up there. Made a playoff start for Springfield, but you kind of still look at kind of the projections. You look at the stuff and the makeup, and you say, okay, you know, he was still 21 years old at that level. Showed some flashes, like okay, like this is who Tim Kent could be. Got a lot more innings than he had ever had coming into this year, and that was a big thing for him. And you still look at like, okay, like this is a longer term type project, but this is still a guy who is kind of one of those blue chip prospects that, you know, you has the stuff to be a valuable piece to big league club. And injuries can be kind of the case for some of the other prospects in the system. Cooper Jerpy had his season wiped out for about 3 months because of elbow surgery. We'll get a little bit of runtime in the fall league just because, I mean, it's limited action. He's coming out of the bullpen there, kind of get some innings under him there. Same thing, Gordon Graceffo missed about 2 months as well with the right shoulder inflammation. Came back at the end of the year and kind of had to get that velo back up again and get built up again. He made a couple of bullpen appearances in September as kind of a way to get him some more innings. And then you look at Michael McGreevy, who's kind of the interesting one because he stayed healthy. He threw a ton of innings for Memphis after he was moved up there from Springfield, and really showed kind of the consistency in innings, but I think there's just still that lack of that swing and the miss, and that's something that McGreevy kind of acknowledges, right, where he knows his profile as a pitcher is the ground ball guy, mm-hmm. Gonna get weak contact, keep the ball on the ground. I mean, there's games where I forget which game it was, but I mean, he recorded 10 ground outs, no fly outs, and got through, you know, 6 innings, which is really kind of the Michael McGreevy that's kind of the pitcher that he is in his profile.
He'd be the fifth starter for the Cardinals 10 years ago.
Right. And when you look at what the game is shifting towards, what obviously John Mozeliak talked about leading up to the deadline, where they're looking for pitching and looking for guys with that swing and miss. I mean, you kind of look at Michael McGreevy and kind of where he fits into the whole formula for the Cardinals pitching equation heading into next year, and it's a little bit different, right, than where it might have been a year ago, just because of obviously where their needs are at, what they might be looking for this offseason, and just kind of where does he fit in that equation with the stuff that he has. I mean, you just kind of wonder, right, where, like, how does he kind of get his name back into this mix?
Was there a young pitcher for both of you guys? Was there a young pitcher that you saw in the majors or a new to the majors early in his career pitcher that you think, all right, this guy's going to contribute and maybe even contribute in a meaningful and substantive way in 2024? Was there somebody who stood out to you, Lynn?
I don't know if I could say definitively, like as in he's definitely going to contribute, but one that I want to see how things unfold and I think could be a contributor is going to be Zach Thompson, because I think especially the first part of the year just seemed to be disjointed for him, and I think that played into some of the troubles he had when he was at AAA. But I mean, like, he looked like he was going to be a decent piece for them out of the bullpen early. Then when they sent him down and then when they started stretching him out to start, it seemed like, you know, he couldn't command the strike zone down at AAA. Part of that might have been ABS. Part of that might have been, changing roles and doing things on the fly. But at the end of the season, when he came back up, and they originally said he was going to be coming up to relieve, and then he made a spot start, and then he made got put back into the rotation. I think you saw signs there of a guy who could be a starter, who he still wants to add, you know, the changeup more into the mix, and something that I remember talking to him, and he's saying that was something he'd probably look at in the offseason as far as how to actually, you know, whether it meant changing with grips or just trying to tweak that. But just having that slider / cutter, I think on StatCast stuff it usually comes up as a cutter, but he calls it a slider. But just giving him that third pitch as far as a different movement profile and also just location-wise, I think as a starter we saw that really play up a little bit, or at least bring his whole arsenal up a little bit down the stretch. So how that unfolds, what he does this offseason as far as, you know, working with that changeup, just overall being able to, you know, add on some bulk, because I think he talked about being able to maintain velocity throughout. Mm-hmm. So just, I think he's one that jumps out to me, even maybe more so than like Liberatore, who was the one that everybody sort of centered on when, you know, you saw the troubles with Mats and the rotation. Everybody's like, oh, you got to bring up Liberatore. What are they waiting for? To me, I think even more so what I saw from Thompson makes me think that's the guy to keep the eye on as far as being able to contribute immediately and potentially in a starting role. I'm not saying, you know, for folks who want to say, oh, that's going to take away, that's one more free agent they don't need to sign. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that I think of the guys, that's the one that jumps out to me.
He went straight from Zach Thompson, went straight from the Cardinals clubhouse from pack up and the end of the season to Charlotte to then throw there to have his biomechanics and his delivery and his stuff kind of workshopped and looked at because they think, like, get consistent mechanics, that means more consistent velocity. He said that he went there because he obviously is during the season, so he doesn't have to ramp up and get going at full speed again, so might as well do it at the end of the season. And he also made the point that his plan is to pitch in October, so why not continue pitching in October and see what that's like, which I thought was interesting. Did Liberatore switch to reliever intrigue you at all, Daniel, as you watched that unfold, knowing what he was like as a starter in the minors, talking to him there as you did? Did his switch to relief intrigue you at all?
Yeah, I mean, especially because you see some of the stuff that he has, right? I mean, you saw early in the year in the minor league season, Matthew Liberatore was one of the guys who benefited from some of the big leaguers out of camp because he got more run time in big league camp, just got more innings, got built up a little bit quicker, and comes into April for Memphis with fastball that's, you know, nearing 98, throwing a ton of strikes, getting the swing and miss that, you know, is needed to get those strikeouts, and comes up and you kind of wonder, okay, like, what kind of happened to that fastball velo you saw down there? But I think that switch to the bullpen, I mean, it's kind of like a reverse Zach Thompson, right? Where he made the switch to being a starter in Memphis, obviously had to kind of manage his, like, the pace in game, velocity was a little bit lower. But I mean, I think when you see what Liberatore possesses and kind of that possibility of being a guy with the plus fastball, obviously the curveball can get some swing and miss. And you look at, I mean, a guy who has two solid pitches out of the bullpen, I mean, it does intrigue you a little bit, right? And to see how he'll attack this offseason and come into next spring with kind of with those goals of, you know, sticking in the majors. I mean, he has the stuff and obviously the build to kind of get there.
All right, so what do they do? We talked a little bit about what went wrong with 2024. Moving on from that, what do they do? What do they, or I'm sorry, 2023. See, I'm already like moving forward, even in thinking back on things. So what do they do? What do they do, Lynn? What are some of the things that they need to do this winter, and where are the solutions going to be found so that next year they flip their record or even aim higher and try to be one of the better teams in the National League?
Well, also, I think just to sort of wrap up that last topic, when because we mentioned pitching, and like I said, pitching was the main thing. Yeah. That also includes bullpen too. Like,
sure.
To me, like we talk, obviously, people focus on starters, but and I think bullpen, at least to me, year to year, like you can sort of put that together, and I almost always feel like bullpen is a year to year proposition. So I mean, I think every year you're almost maybe not redoing, but almost retooling your bullpen.
That's a great point.
And so it'll be interesting. Like, I mean, I know, like you mentioned with Thompson, I know Ryan Helsley was talking about one of the things he was going to do at the end of the season was he was going to stay around for a little while longer, and he was supposedly going to do a deep dive with the Cardinals staff that was, you know, training staff, also pitching staff, as far as just going through mechanical stuff, because obviously he missed a big chunk of the season due to the injury. And part of the deep dive was going to be analyzing sort of like, you know, mechanically, physically, if there's anything that, like, you know, he needed to tweak to try and prevent, you know, or that might have been contributing to him missing as much time as he did this season. I mean, I'm trying to remember what the number was, but it was like, had to be like 80 games, right? Or maybe even more than that.
It was 3 months, yeah.
Yeah, so it was a long stretch, and then also had sort of, you know, some fits and starts as far as coming back with the rehab process. So I know he was one who was going to do that as soon as the season ended. At least that's what he had said on the final day of the season. But so I think getting, you know, it's not just a matter of, you know, going out signing some starters. It's also deciding on some of these guys in the bullpen. I also feel like trying to figure out, you know, some of the logjam stuff that we saw at the beginning of the season in places like the outfield, middle infield, making decisions and, you know, on how you're going to go forward from that is going to be key next year, in terms of like actually knowing what that lineup is going to look like and knowing which pieces are still going to be here and, you know, whether those some players are, you know, non-tendered or trade possibilities or what you're going to do. Because this season it seemed like there was a lot, at least that first month, of trying to get guys playing time, trying to get guys into a rhythm, trying to make sure we get this guy in regular at bats, and it ended up being where you just really weren't accomplishing much of any of that. And I don't feel like they can do that going into next season again.
Did you have a feel for how much of that was the creation of the roster and how much of that was the usage of the roster?
I lean towards more the creation of the roster, but at the same time, I mean, when they sat down and decided what this roster was going to look like, they had a plan for what the usage was going to be. So, I mean, I guess really it comes down to both, because I feel like you create the roster thinking that you're going to be able to get guys time and you're going to be able to balance these things out. Mm-hmm. The execution of that didn't play out the way that either they planned on it, or the way they planned on it just didn't play out to work for the players involved. So I'm not sure if you could say it's one or the other, but I feel like if you planned it out that way, then if you designed it that way as far as the roster construction, then the plan to make sure it all worked just either didn't fit or wasn't executed the way that you wanted it to. And injuries played into that too, because I mean, like, it seemed like there was always, you know, whether, I know Mo mentioned a few times in the first month or so how much time was missed by the combination of Tyler O'Neill and Lars Nootbaar. So injuries did play into that, but in some ways that made it a little bit easier to get some of these guys playing time that, you know, you weren't going to be able to really get as much time as you wanted to.
They had like something like 40 different outfield combinations, which is just bonkers. And I think they had something like 36 different center fielders. I think that's rough estimate. Didn't it feel that way? 36? Am I a little high on that, Daniel?
And about half of those guys also played infield at some point.
Right, that's right, that's right. Yeah. They had 36 different Tommy Edmonds out there. Well, so I like what you're saying, that like the changing this team is not just changing the rotation. That's where the biggest improvement could happen, right? I mean, are we all in agreement there that like that the biggest improvement could be made through free agency, through trade with the starting rotation, right?
The the most evident, easiest improvement. Yeah, I mean, because
most expensive.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, it's also the one where it's like you sign the check and then in theory you improve in this area. I mean, like, there's improvements that can be made individually with, you know, players, guys' growth, but those also aren't, you know, you can't necessarily count on or expect a certain amount of improvement. Like, you don't know what you're going to get. Like, you know, like, there's plenty of guys. We went around, you know, all of us around the locker room, the clubhouse that last day, and guys talking about things they want to improve on. But that's what you hear at the end of the season everywhere. I mean, at least every place I've been, whether it's minor leagues, major leagues, there's always guys talking about the list of things they're going to improve on in the offseason. But the pitching staff signing free agents is an automatic. You improve by getting a player who's better than the one that you have now. So, yeah, I guess that was the, you know, free agency is the biggest place, and you know that pitching is going to be their target free agency. So that's probably the place where you expect the biggest improvement. But if some guys who have sort of shown flashes make big leaps, then maybe those become the even more important improvements you see once the season starts.
Are there some of the free agents, some of the trades that kind of catch your eye, Daniel? I mean, do you think that there are options out there that significantly change the look of the team, or could it just be more of the same?
I mean, I think there definitely are. I mean, and you turn on any postseason game now and you see what these teams' makeup are, and you see especially with the starting pitching and what having bona fide, you know, frontline starters does for rotation, that changes the makeup of a team completely. And I mean, you look at the Cardinals' offense this year, I mean, they had a lot of guys who were productive. And I mean, even, I know you mentioned like Lars Nootbaar, who battled with injury. I mean, he still had a productive year.
Yeah, he led the team in WAR.
Right. And you look at Wilson Contreras, who obviously dealing with outside noise, feeling in like a new place, the switch from not catching to apparently playing left field, but not playing left field, and just DHing, and then see the year he had at the end of the year. You see what Nolan Gorman did in his second year, I mean, despite the injuries. And you kind of look at like a lot of things like that, and I know like Lynn mentioned about kind of guys, you look at kind of guys banking on like, okay, like this is going to be a productive offseason. You're going to come in, you know, the best you've ever felt into spring. But I mean, at the same time, like you need to address the problems of pitching, and you look at kind of this incoming free agent class, or you look at some of the guys who are trade candidates, and you also look at, like I said, what you see in these postseason games where you have starters who are going six innings and providing swing and miss and, you know, piling up those strikeouts, and you see kind of what these other teams are doing, and that, I mean, you can see that there are options out there that quickly improve the Cardinals heading into next year.
It's been on my mind a lot here, and I want to run this by you guys, like this notion of, like, continuity and continuing what the Cardinals have. When they talk about the starting rotation, it's like this guy taught this guy taught this guy. You know, you trace the lineage back to whoever you want to go back to. You can go to Daryl Kyle, Woody Williams, Pat Hankin, and you know, what they passed on to Matt Morris, and Matt Morris and Woody Williams, what they passed on to Chris Carpenter, and then Chris Carpenter to Adam Wainwright. You know, we all know it by rote if we've been around, you know, and watched it and recited it and heard Wainwright talk about it. The biggest, most significant change was obviously a catcher this past year, going from nearly two decades of Yadier Molina behind the plate to Wilson Contreras, who was, you know, an offense first catcher. They knew that going in. And in some ways, a mistake they made was trying to ask, not in some ways, but a mistake they may have made was asking Wilson Contreras to be a catcher like they expected, as opposed to changing catcher to be what they could expect from Wilson Contreras. And we'll see if that changes this winter. But the notion of continuity has me thinking a lot. Like, is it a case where maybe that's what the lesson of this year is, that a new continuity has to begin? Not the, you know, this is how it's been for 20 years and this will carry on, that there are certain elements of that. But maybe now that Cardinals have a chance to redefine, even reimagine themselves, as that era is done, Adam Wainwright has retired, Yadier Molina is now a year removed, that now it's time to put together a roster from a pitching battery standpoint that defines the next era and see where it takes us. And do the Cardinals need to a little bit allow those new players, and that includes Contreras, to define what that looks like and allow Dusty Blake to define what that looks like and have it be a mix of strikeouts and have it be a mix of tech. Like, is that what we're seeing here, that this is a break from the continuity and the start of something new?
I don't know if it's what we saw, but I feel like naturally it might be what we see going forward, just because you're going to change over a good chunk of at least starting rotation. So the guy who will be there, at least as of right now, is Contreras. And you know that you'll have him for the next four seasons, at least, you know, on paper at this point. And so he's the one who will be, at least right now, the continuity piece going forward. You know you'll have Miles for the next couple years. I mean, but you don't know how much longer you'll have, you know, or who else is going to be there for the long term aside from Contreras. You know, and he's the one who's been working with the current pitching staff, the young guys coming up. And then when you bring in new guys, which they're going to do this offseason, the guy that they will have known, or they will get to know, is Contreras. So I feel like that, like, you're going to see, I don't know if you necessarily saw the need this season that that's what needs to happen, but I think it's naturally what's going to happen, because the guy who's going to be there is the catcher, and you're going to change over a whole lot of staff, and they're going to be working with this guy. So it's going to get further and further away from, well, the way we did it with Yadi. There's not going to be that many guys left who did it with Yadi. It's going to be, you know, a couple of guys who, you know, had, and none of them had as much experience with Yadi as, like, you know, Waino and all these other guys. Like, that era, as far as, you know, dealing with the pitcher-catcher stuff, is going to be, you know, getting further and further away. There's not going to be that many guys here in St. Louis who have actually had that. So it's going to be Contreras, and that's what they're going to be used to. And they're going to be working with Dusty Blake. And it's going to be, you know, like you said, whether it's the tech or, you know, just looking at pitching, you know, I think Mo's used the term modern, you know, like that's what, more modern tools and all that sort of stuff. So that's going to be naturally, I think, what unfolds. It will be interesting to see just, like, you know, how that shows up on a day-to-day basis. The one thing that I'm interested to see is, like, with Contreras, because of the fire that he plays with, I feel like that can be something that sort of, like, reverberates around the team, especially with the young guys. And I feel like there was moments when we saw little bits of that this year. Like, there was – I don't remember the series or the game where I want to say, like, remember talking to Nolan Gorman, hits his big home run and is, like, pumping his fist and sort of, like, going crazy as he looks at the dugout. And I think, remember I was talking to him afterwards, and he was like, yeah, I don't even know what I did. Like, you know, but, like, some of that fire, and I feel like that from guys like him who don't necessarily show it all the time, but when you can get that out of him, you get it out of some of the young guys, if that means, like, you know, Mason Wynn coming up, who I think is built for that sort of a reaction on the field. I think, you know, Walker, I think he was even one of the ones who was losing his mind on the bench when Gorman hit a home run. It might have been that one, or it might have been another one. So I feel like that's the type of thing that you might see as far as just, like, the physical manifestations, the things you can actually, like, look at and point at and say that might be part of Contreras sort of gaining a foothold, or just sort of, like, you know, his personality becoming part of the team personality, one of the ones that you can point at.
Some of the changes that are part of that, it's like we both mentioned, is the introduction of tech, the discussion of whiffs, the pitch crafting, you know, all the data that goes into then helping guys not just shape pitches, but shape how they use their pitches, particularly like pitch sequencing, which can be a big thing, or pitch focus, like, hey, ditch the pitch that you might like but doesn't get a whole lot of results and focus on the pitch that does get results. Then how do you expect this to kind of manifest in the minors? Do you see some evidence of that already trickling down to the minors? The Cardinals had this overhaul of how they approached hitting when they hired Jeff Albert. It sure seems like they're poised to have that conversation about pitching. Whether Dusty Blake has a big part in that, you know, he's got his hands full with the major league, but Tim Levesque has been a big part of this and really through the past decade plus has really been involved in that. How do you see what is being talked about at the major league level trickling down into the minors and influencing things there?
Well, I know Zach Thompson arrived at the major. I mean, has been in the majors for a couple of seasons now, but I mean, I think he's a good example of kind of what that could look like. I remember talking to him when down in Memphis after he got optioned, and he mentioned that, you know, that it was just the fastball curveball combo, because as a reliever you needed two pitches, and that's the bread and butter. I mean, those are the two pitches you're gonna rely on. I mean, you can ditch the slider and changeup. Obviously, you had to kind of dust those off and get a grip on those again to be able to bring those back. But I do think you're kind of seeing a little bit with some of the guys that are kind of looking at, like, draft-wise. I mean, I think you saw it with when they took Cooper Jerpy, and you kind of pivot to a guy like, okay, he has a swing and miss. He has kind of a couple pitches that you can lean on that could make him a quick riser. I think there are a couple other guys in the system where you kind of have kind of a little bit of that profile too. Like Bryson Motz is another one who spent the whole season down in low A. But I mean, yeah, I could see that kind of trickling down, right? Where you kind of have a few guys who have those pitches to the repertoire that, you know, mm-hmm. they can lean on for what they're looking for. And you're kind of seeing them, like you mentioned, just kind of just hone in on using what's going to work best for them.
I want to get some outside perspective too, Lynn, which you bring because you covered the Royals for a while, and also covered the Mets in the minor league system. So you got and you've been other places, whereas I've just been here in St. Louis watching the Cardinals for so long. That after a season like this. Are you the Cardinals want to bring back their coaching staff? They may add to it. They may have conversations about guys who want to go elsewhere. All that stuff is still in play as we go through this. But they have not made, and they do not plan to make any dramatic changes. And that might be the case too throughout the organization, where they don't make these dramatic moves that get headlines, and instead augment and expand. From your experience, when you've covered teams that have struggled, that have fallen, into last place or fallen in the standings or fallen short of their expectations, does it strike you a little bit that they've said, okay, no, we got the group in place to lead this. We got this in place and we want to see it through, as opposed to making changes? And what do you think that message sends? Where's the element of accountability there?
Well, I'm not surprised at the major league level if there's not a whole lot of changes, just because I think just look back to last year and you think, okay, well, you know, from last year to this year, you changed the hitting coach, the bench coach, and the pitching coach. Mm-hmm. So 1 year later, to talk major changes to me feels like, well, okay, are you changing just for the sake of change, or did you identify something specifically that you say, okay, that is not good enough, or that, like, there's failures there that this person specifically is responsible for, and we need to change to get back on track? Because if it's change just for the sake of change so that you can say you're changing, that's one thing. But if there's something specific that you're seeing, I feel like that would be the thing that would make me want to change. It's like, okay, we see this specifically is not going the way that it should be, and it's because of this particular coach. We need somebody else in that spot who can take care of that. So if they're not seeing things that they say, that they can point and say that this guy, his failures are what's causing this, and I'm not sure, and I know people want to look at the pitching, but I feel like that, like, you could as easily point to the personnel on the pitching side and say that that's what was going on in some cases, or the fact that, you know, and I know that one of the things that I think we talked, you know, late in the season, I know they talked about adding, and one of the spots, like, you know, that spot that Dusty came up from never really got filled. It just sort of got spread across other people, that strategist position.
Or ball put on him in addition to being a pitching coach.
It's basically like, you know, his first year learning how to be a pitching coach in the big leagues, he was also sort of still doing at least a chunk of his old job while taking on this new job.
And trying to catch up a team that had fallen many years behind.
And bringing a new catcher and guys who...
Great point.
Yeah, who had been used to this other catcher for 20 years. So I think that goes... So I'm not surprised that, you know, I say all that to say I'm not surprised that they didn't say, okay, for the second year row, we're going to just, like, retool the major league staff. I think the thing that would be more surprising is, it remains to be seen, is like, okay, what does that mean in the minor league level, the player development level? So, like, if there's things that they feel like they haven't done, or that maybe they're still behind the curve, or maybe an old way of thinking with their development, whether that's pitching development is probably what first comes to mind, then maybe there's changes there. And, you know, it's funny, you talk about, you know, like things trickling down. And it seems to me like even more so now you're seeing almost organizations structure that way, where, like, you know, and I think I've heard Ollie say this, and I know I heard with the Royals, we talk about the pitching department, the hitting department. It's not just like the hitting coach, you know, at the major league level. The minor league development staff is completely different. It's like that top-down thing where the major league staff sort of trickles down. I think it's more what you see more. Like, I mean, the Royals were a perfect example where when they switched out the hitting coach, they took the person who was in charge of the hitting department and made him the hitting coach in the major leagues. And that's still the guy who's the hitting coach in the major leagues now. And I think when they hired a pitching coach, they were also were sort of thinking about, like, that influence. Like, they hired a hitting coach. I mean, a pitching coach. They also hired new people to sort of head up a lot of the pitching development and made sure that they were all aligned. And so I think that's probably more of what you're seeing nowadays, where it's not just the major league guy is in charge of the major league staff. It's like that guy more so has sort of a top down as far as like what their organizational approach is to these
organizational ethos. They did with it.
And that's why you like that term department, you know, it's like a small thing, but to me, like, it's a signal of like, okay, it's not just he's in charge of the hitters and the major league staff. It's like, no, there's, you know, he's ahead of this whole top-down sort of, you know, arrangement as far as the hitting development and how they, you know, go about hitting. And same thing with the pitching department, top-down. So if that means, you know, maybe there's some changes on the player development side, how those align with somebody like Dusty Blake, that would be interesting to me. Like, that's the thing. And if they stick with the same approach, I guess that would maybe be more surprising to me than definitely more surprising than the lack of changes on the major league staff.
And to me, the fact that you haven't seen this, for lack of a better word, scapegoating, and instead you've had discussions of solutions, in some ways the responsibility you see is being taken on by the front office. The front office saying, look, the roster we gave the coaches, or the tools we gave the coaches, the setup we gave the coaches, that did not work. The coaches made the most of it, and the most of it was a 91 loss team. But them saying, like, that roster just was clunky and not coordinated, and this is the result. And them not saying, all right, well, we're changing some of the coaches, or we're moving on from the manager, or all those things. That to me says that they're taking on responsibility, but they're also taking on the challenge of the offseason. Since I have you guys both here, I'd be remiss not to kind of like close out the podcast with a couple quick questions. All right, Daniel, what was your favorite story of this year? We've talked a lot about, like, the things that went wrong and the things they have to do, but let's change the tone a little bit. What was, like, a story that you did this year, or a conversation you had, or topic that you wrote on that really stood out to you?
Well, I guess I'll go back to how we opened this podcast with Victor Scott II. I mean, getting a chance to talk to his parents, who were track stars at Morris Brown College, who have one of the sons is one of the fastest players in minor league baseball, and just kind of learning about how his dad is a Morris Brown College Hall of Famer in track and field, kind of played a big role in teaching little Victor how to run properly, essentially. I mean, that having kind of like that track background, although not running track in high school, and how that kind of influenced him, showed him the fundamentals and all the different kind of aspects of how to run, and to seeing him kind of become this prolific base dealer down in the minors and be on this kind of quick path to the majors. I mean, I think that's one of the stories I enjoyed being able to, one of the conversations I definitely enjoyed for sure. And then one of the stories I was, you know, had the pleasure of being able to tell, that's for sure.
Lynn, you were there for Wainwright's 199 in Baltimore, where things started kind of going in the right direction for him, results-wise, not necessarily physically-wise. So that stood out as one of the stories to me that you covered and did well. What for you? What first year on the Cardinal beat, what was a story that you, or conversation, interview, or even like stretch of time that you thought was some of the best stories to be told this year?
To me, the two sort of stories, and it's not like individual like articles, it's sort of how they developed over the course of the season. The two things were Jordan Walker's sort of first impact on the Cardinals in the major leagues from spring training through the end of the season and having gone down in the middle of the season. Just sort of that whole thing to me was one of the most interesting things because, you know, there was the uncertainty and it seemed like he was taking, you know, spring training by storm. And then the whole, you know, where he was up and he was doing well. And then it's like, well, they were sort of like forecasting that some things were going to be coming and then they sent him down and how he dealt with that and then came back and performed. To me, that was the most interesting thing just because of the different layers to it. And then the other one was related to the Wainwright 199 and 200 was Contreras and his whole season as the big free agent acquisition. And, you know, I think back to like your story in spring training about the things that he was going to change and, you know, talking about wanting to be a Gold Glover and they were working with like different things on him, like whether it was with his setup and all this other stuff. And then to, what was it, May, I forget what the date was when they decided, well, he's not catching anymore. He's just going to DH. And then that lasted about 10 days and then he's back catching again. So, and then, just, you know, his first half of the season where he just seemed lost. And he reflected a little bit on it as we got later in the season about trying to do too much in the contract and then just how important it was and how emotional it was for him to be part of 199-200 for Wainwright. I think that those two, probably if I had to pick one, I guess just the Contreras arc of the season was the biggest thing I say as far as a story, I guess more a storyline than a particular article or story.
This would have been this week. There would have been, or there was plans for a postseason press conference, one to wrap up the season, but really more to look forward. That tends to be what those press conferences are about. Cardinals postponed it. They didn't want to rehash. They figured they'd done enough of that. Some of the things that they're working on, some of the questions that they would have faced, they don't yet have answers for as far as structure, as far as you know, how some of the personnel is going to move around, maybe even conversations with Contreras, which the front office wanted to have for where he fits as far as how much catcher. Do they have three catchers going into next year? Is he part of the DH equation? All that stuff is still kind of going on. So as if we had this press conference, gentlemen, what would be a question that you would want answered? What was something that you, as you thought about, all right, we're going into this press conference, is going to happen, and it probably will happen eventually. What's a question that you want to have answered, Lynn?
It's sort of, well, I guess it's a wide-ranging question, I was going to say, because you can make it real specific, but I'd probably, at least for the purposes of this right now, is more like, what are their plans for the outfield? And that gets into specific guys, but like, because you can certainly see where Jordan Walker in right and Newton left would maybe make the most sense, especially with Ollie flat out saying at the end of the season that Newt's best in the corner. But then that leads to the question of who's in center. What does that mean for other positions? Is that Tommy? If so, and that's going to be an everyday outfield, what does that mean for Tyler O'Neill? What does that mean for shortstop? Is that Mason from day one? Like, the trickle down from that is what interests me and where they stand right now on that as far as what does the outfield look like and then what that means for the rest of the field, I think, is the one of the big questions for me.
And for you, Daniel, what was something that you were eager to ask?
I think just looking at the farm system, right, and seeing how they entered the year. I think Baseball America had them ranked 8th. The Cardinals, I think by MLB Pipeline and Baseball America, were well below that ranking to end the year. And I think the question is just what needs to be done for the farm system to be ready to help the big league club immediately. I mean, just because when you look at last year, right, and when you did the Dispatch Dozen ranking, you had guys in that top 12, and Nolan Gorman, Matthew Liberatore, Zach Thompson, Brendan Donovan, Juan Yepes, all those guys eventually were called up last year and contributed. When you look at the Dispatch Dozen this year, I think only two made their debuts. I mean, yeah, one being Jordan Walker, the other being Mason Winn. So what changes need to be made for the farm system to be readily available to help the big league club? I mean, especially for an organization that's prided itself on drafting and developing, just what strides need to be made to catch up ground on other organizations across the league.
That's a great point. And the Cardinals, for a long time, prided themselves on winning in the minor leagues, like creating a winning culture, right? Not just a development culture where it was hyper-localized on what the individual player does in advancing the player. They wanted them involved in winning. It was sometimes you'd see these transactions at the end of the year where guys would move around levels, but that would be so they'd get experience in the postseason and the playoffs and in that type of atmosphere. And Gary LaRocque, the farm director, would talk to players about that. Like, how are you ready to play this late in the season to contend? Because that's what Cardinals do. They contend late in the season. Well, really, coming out of 2020, they haven't. They haven't won at that level. They've lost at one of the most historic losing rates. They had the lowest winning percentage of any minor league organization, not any Cardinals minor league, but any minor league organization, one of the bottom five in the last six decades. So they came out of that with lots of pitching problems. They say it's because they pushed guys, and that there's a lot of proof of that. They pushed them up a level. And you could see that kind of resettle this year, as Daniel and I have talked about with Ian Bedell, where they didn't push guys. But what's been lost is, you think about the guys who won, who are young players who won pennants and won championships here, who moved up together. Alan Craig, John Jay, David Freese, that group, right? They won at every level. Skip Schumacher, they won at every level. They won coming up. They won championships. They won playoff games. They won at every level. You can't say that about Jordan Walker and Mason Winn. They've lost at every level. And so I think it's a real interesting question that you ask, not just on like on a granular level, but also on a grand level. Like, how do you get the winning culture back in the minors? Where does that come from? There were some playoff teams there. There were teams that won in the minors, but how do you get that culture back, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I get you. I mean, that's a good point with Mason and Jordan, where they've drafted together, come up together, but have not been on winning ball clubs at any level thus far. I mean, I think the one outlier in that is Tink Kentz actually has been on winning ball clubs
right.
in the minors, which is interesting. But yeah, but I mean, like you said, there's I remember kind of learning about like that Memphis Mafia, right? Those players that came up in 2011 and contributed to a World Series win. And how do you, like, that's a good question. I mean, how do you get that back and how do you sustain it, especially?
To me, the question is, are they willing to meet the market and not? And that is a question that has recurred through the years and it's come up. But, you know, if anything, this has really put that in relief. You know, are they willing to meet the market price for pitching? Are they willing to go past their risk-averse trends and meet the market price for pitching? Whether and how creative they can get with trades so that they don't have to. You know, those two, they almost have to win on both tracks there. They have to be successful signing a free agent, and they have to be successful making a trade, it seems. So how do they do that? And so far, every indication is that ownership has given the go-ahead. They understand that the market's changed. They understand it's going to cost more. They understand it's going to be high risk, and you may not get the return if there's an injury happen. But they've said, go ahead. They all say they're on the same page. But for me, the question is, okay, how does that manifest? How does that mean that the Cardinals eagerly hop and skip and jump and raise their arm in an auction? Or are they still going to be hesitant to do that because they don't think they can win one? I'm really eager to see that. So that leads us with the one last thing to talk about. And Lynn touched on it. And I wanted to kind of veer back to where we began with Victor Scott. I think it's really interesting the number of different ways that once the dust settles on this offseason, the positions could sort out. There is a way, right, where Victor Scott is part of the center field conversation, where Thomas Sagesi is part of the infield. Is that something that's possible in spring training? That, hey, if speed and stolen bases is more of the game, and the Cardinals think, well, they might need Tommy Edman in the infield, is there a way where Victor Scott zooms ahead into the equation? Is there a way where if Tommy Edman is the starting shortstop, that Sagesi is and Brendan Donovan are kind of the utility guys, or Brendan Donovan's in left field? I mean, how many different directions could this go? And do you see the opening for a young guy like a Victor Scott to speed his way into the conversation?
To me, that depends on who is not here when they get to spring training, as in via trade or just roster move or whatever, you know, if they non-tender somebody or, you know, just who's not here. Because I feel like you already have a number of guys here that you're not sure how they all fit. So there has to be some subtraction, at least in my mind, before you can start adding some of these other guys into the equation.
Yeah, I mean, just like you said, especially when you mentioned Thomas Ajayi, and you look at this depth that they have at the middle infield of guys who are utility infielders, Ajayi fits that profile as well, right? I mean, he plays around the diamond. But I think when they show up to Jupiter in spring, who is on the roster and who isn't kind of will signal like, okay, if these youngsters, these guys who are, only drafted a few years ago, do they have a chance at having an impact and cracking the big league club?
That is Daniel Guerrero, baseball writer at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Also joining me is Lynn Worthy, baseball writer at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It's been great to catch up with you guys. I really appreciate you taking the time. You can find all of their work at stltoday.com and in the pages of the Post-Dispatch. Of course, you can hear them on the Best Podcast in Baseball, which is brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. You can find the Best Podcast in Baseball anywhere you get your podcasts. So you can rate and review it on iTunes. You can subscribe to it. Subscriptions make sponsorships possible. Sponsorships make the podcast possible. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciated this conversation. It was great. Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you.
Thanks, Daniel.
Yeah, thanks.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for coming over to the Treehouse to record this. For Lynn Worthy and Daniel Guerrero of the Post-Dispatch, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. This has been the Best Podcast in Baseball. We'll talk to you soon.